Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Davidson, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled Masters of Enterprise, a History of American Business and Those Who Made It. Your professor is H.W. Brands, a prolific and award-winning writer who's currently Distinguished Professor of History and holder of the Melbourne G. Glasscock Chair in American History at Texas A&M in College Station, Texas. Professor Brands earned a B.A. in History from Stanford University in 1975. After spending a year working as a traveling salesman, Brands took a job teaching history in Portland, Oregon's Jesuit High School, while earning both an M.A. in Liberal Studies from Reed College and an M.S. in Mathematics from Portland State University. He went on to receive his Ph.D. in History from the University of Texas. Brands is the author of 17 books, has edited 4 others, and has published dozens of articles and reviews in publications ranging from the New York Times to the American Historical Review. Since the formation of the American Republic, the principles of free enterprise and equal opportunity have been at the very core of economic philosophy. During the Revolution, colonists fought not only for intangibles like liberty and justice, but also for the promises of a free market that provided everyone with the opportunity to pursue economic advancement regardless of social position and without interference from the crown. America quickly became a society in which an individual's success would be measured not by birthright, but rather by determination. In this atmosphere, men and women have sought fortune limited only by their own abilities, their willingness to work hard, and their courage in the face of unknown dangers. In this course, we'll explore the lives and careers of successful men and women who seized the opportunities offered by the vibrant and open economy that ensued. We'll examine how each of these individuals found the necessary resources, both economic and personal, to achieve greatness in the business arena. In doing so, we hope not only to arrive at a better understanding of American business history in general, but also to commune with its greatest visionaries, its masters of enterprise. For more information on this lecture, please visit the course's webpage at www.modernscholar.com, where you'll have access to links to related sites, a seminar room to share your thoughts with other students, and yes, of course, a final exam. And now we begin Masters of Enterprise, A History of American Business and Those Who Made It. Lecture 1, The Business of America. And now, Professor Brands.
The business of America is business, said Calvin Coolidge. And the history of business is the stories of the people who made it. This course is about American business history. Its format is a series of lectures, of sketches of important figures in the history of American business. There are going to be several themes that will emerge from this course. One is that the history of American business can be seen as a window on American history generally. There are various ways of examining American history. One can look at the politics, one can look at the ideals, one can look at American military history, one can look at American social or cultural history. Another way of looking at it is through the history of American business. One thing that Americans have done consistently from the 18th century until the present is deal with the problem of how to make a living. And by examining the evolution of American business, of how people have made a living, I think we're going to get a chance to get right at the heart of what American life was like for all sorts of people from then until now. A second theme that's going to emerge from the course is the distinction between business history and economic history. Business history is the history of businesses, of enterprises, of firms. Economic history is the history of the American economy, the larger terms of employment, of production, of the relationships of one industry to another. This is going to play an important role in what we're going to be doing. And in fact, at times I'll be looking at American business history through the lens of American economic history. But it's important to distinguish the two. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time dealing with matters of employment, with production levels and the like. Those will come in to the degree that they affect the businesses and the business people we're dealing with. But for the most part, we're going to be focusing on the history of American business. A third theme that will emerge in the course is the role of entrepreneurs, of individual enterprises. Now, one shouldn't believe that enterprise, that entrepreneurs are the only important figures in American business. In fact, in the 20th century, the role of corporations, of large organizations that are run by groups of people that don't necessarily own the corporations, will become important. And we'll follow some of those individuals. But peculiarly in American history, in the history of American business, individual entrepreneurs, the individuals who have the ideas, who start the businesses, who identify with the businesses, these are the driving force in American business history. And these are the people we are going to focus on. Karl Marx once said that people make their history, but not in circumstances of their own choosing. Now, I think some people might find it humorous, ironic, that Karl Marx is being quoted here in a course on American business history. But in fact, I think that anybody who looks at Marx's writings will discover that Marx was a rather acute student, a rather acute observer of business history, and especially of the history of what he would call capitalism. Well, we're going to take a leaf from Marx and examine the roles of the entrepreneurs, the individuals who make American business history, but not in circumstances of their choosing. In fact, one of the important themes of the course and one of the ideas we're going to pursue is the degree to which individual enterprise has to adjust to the terms of American economy, to the terms of American politics, over the course of the two centuries we're going to be dealing with. The successful entrepreneurs of the 18th and early 19th century are not the same types of persons. They're not the same individuals. They don't have the same sets of skills as successful entrepreneurs in the 20th and early 21st centuries. And that's going to be something we're going to deal with again and again. I'll be coming back to this in the course of the lectures. Another theme is the role of technology. Technology in American economic history, and technology in particular as it affects the work of American business people. The technological changes are some of the obvious things: the role of science, the emergence of different means of production, distribution, consumption. But it's going to play an important role at every stage in American business history. In fact, it isn't too much to say that American businesses are actually the agency by which American technology comes into American daily life. The scientists are out there working on their inventions, but the inventions don't become an important part of American life generally until they find their way into business. It's business that introduces technology. It's business that sells the technology to the American people. Fifth theme that I'm going to be developing over the course of the lectures is the role of government in American business history and in American economic history generally. In the year 1776, which for convenience sake we'll take as the beginning of the course, it was, after all, the date on which America claimed independence. In 1776, there were two landmark documents. One could almost call them two manifestos that were published that year. The first one, the one with which Americans are most familiar, was Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, which established the political framework through which American politics is going to be viewed. By declaring that all men were created equal, Jefferson established the framework for American democracy. It would take a while for democracy to fully evolve, but that is the groundwork. This is the basis for American political history. In that same year, in 1776, a Scottish philosopher, economist we would call him now, Adam Smith, published a book called The Wealth of Nations. This work is generally considered to be the founding document, the manifesto of modern capitalism. And one way, one important way of viewing the evolution of American economic and business history is to consider the interplay between Thomas Jefferson and Adam Smith, between the Declaration of Independence and the Wealth of Nations. The Declaration of Independence posits that all men are created equal. Now, one of the things we'll discover is that Adam Smith's Wealth of Nations premises the development of American capitalism, American business, and capitalism generally, on the notion of inequality. It's inequality that drives businesses to do what they do. It's inequality that drives the economy. So we've got these two values that Americans embrace, the value of political democracy with its premise of equality, and the value of capitalism, private enterprise, with its premise of inequality. One of the things that Americans have to do, American business people and Americans generally have to do over the course of the two centuries that we're going to be dealing with, is to figure out how to reconcile these two values. What do we do when they come into conflict? It's easy to think that, in fact, democracy and capitalism fit neatly together. Well, at times they do, at times they don't. And one of the things that we're going to be examining over the course of these lectures is how the fit has been made, how the adjustments between democracy and capitalism have been made over the course of American history. Those are the themes that we're going to be dealing with in the course. And now I'd like to give a brief overview of the developments of American business history. I'm going to basically run through 200 years of American business history in the next 20 minutes. So hold your breath and here we go. The first chapter, you might say, we're going to be looking at the colonial beginnings of American business. It's important to remember that several of the American colonies were first established as business ventures. The Virginia colony, for example, was established, the Jamestown colony was established by the Virginia Company. And it was promoted, it was intended to be a money-making venture. This establishes the theme of business, of private enterprise, from the very beginning, from the early 17th century. Now, it's worth bearing in mind that this wasn't the only model for American colonialism. The other model was the religious model. The Massachusetts colony, for example, was established as a religious refuge for dissenters from the established religion in England. So we're going to see a tension here in American colonial history, but this is a tension that persists right on through American history. On the one hand, the colonies were established to make money. They were a business venture. On the other hand, they were established as a religious refuge. Now, at times, in very many cases, Americans are going to try to reconcile these two notions, money-making with the role of religion. And we'll see that that does form an important theme in American history. After we get through the American colonial beginnings, the really important event, the one that's going to let us jump off into the full-blown discussion of American business history, is the American Revolution. Now, every student of American history knows that the theme of the American revolutionaries was no taxation without representation. And that was perfectly true. It's worth bearing in mind, however, that many of those people who were objecting most to taxes were the business folks who were having to pay the taxes. The taxes on tea, for example, and the monopoly on tea that was given to the British East India Company was what prompted the Boston Tea Party. There were various other regulations that constrained American businesses that were a principal cause of the American Revolution. There were the Navigation Acts, for example. These prevented American manufacturers from engaging in the production of iron and steel products, for example. There was an important restriction that was placed on American businesses in 1763 when the British government forbade the settlement of new developments in the territory across the Appalachians. One of the things that is important to remember in American business history is the role of speculation, the idea of making investment with the hope that this investment will pay off in great form in the future. The speculators who were speculating in those days in American land, in Western lands, were exceedingly upset when the British said that they could no longer speculate in the Western lands. And the annoyance, the outrage of the speculators, was a principal role, was a principal motive, and a principal driver of the American Revolution. In fact, in the first lecture, the first substantive lecture, the one after this, when I talk about John Jacob Astor, we'll see that John Jacob Astor honed speculation into a fine art that made him the wealthiest man in America. This was exactly what the American colonists were upset about, the notion that the British were going to prevent them from doing this. The American Revolution was a success. The Americans gained their independence after a war that lasted from 1775 until 1783. With independence, Americans congratulated themselves on this great work well done. They discovered that they were now free from British restraints. They no longer had to pay taxes to the British government. They no longer had to abide by the British navigation laws. They could trade wherever they wanted. But they also discovered that they were free now from British protection. The downside of being part of the British Empire was that American businesses couldn't do quite what they wanted. The upside of the British Empire was that American businesses were protected by the largest and most powerful fleet in the world. So Americans enter independence, national independence in the 1780s, freed from the restraints but also freed from protection. They have to figure out how they're going to get along in a world where their former protector is now their principal competitor. As we will see, for the first 40 years of American independence, this was a major problem, not only for American politics, that most obviously, but also for American commerce. Another problem that arose with independence was the determination of how strong the central government could be. I mentioned earlier in the themes that I'm going to develop in the course, the role of government. Well, in fact, the role of government plays a principal part of American thinking regarding business from the very beginning. In the 1780s, the states were supreme in American politics. And with the supremacy of the states was a certain chaos that developed in the American economy. As businesses in one state lobbied for protection against businesses from another state, as one state, for example, would slap import duties on products from another state. During the course of the 1780s, American businesses became one of the principal forces arguing for a stronger central government. They believed that the very weak government that was established during the American Revolutionary War under the Articles of Confederation simply wasn't strong enough to provide the framework for the emergence of a strong American business class. One of the things that we'll see and will develop over the course is the notion that government has to set the rules, has to establish the framework in which business operates. Business, by and large, wants to be free of government restraints. But there's a minimal amount of rule setting, of law enforcing that business requires in order for it to proceed fruitfully and profitably. During the late 1770s and the early 1780s, under the Articles of Confederation, most businesses came to believe that the pendulum had swung too far from the strong government under Britain to a weak government under the Articles of Confederation. And so in the late 1780s, culminating in 1787 with the writing of the new federal constitution, the business classes decided that they needed a strong government. In fact, in those days, it was a fairly common notion for businesses to think of government as their ally. Now, later on, business would take the notion that government was their enemy. And by the 20th century, for example, it was fairly common for businesses to think that the smaller government, the better. In the 1780s, the business classes were just on the opposite side. Government had become too small. What they wanted was a stronger government to wage a campaign on behalf of business. They saw stronger government as being pro-business. In the 1790s and in the first decades of the 19th century, first decades of the 1800s, the principal problems for American business, now that they got the government that they wanted at home, what they needed was protection for American commerce overseas. One of the points that I'll develop in the course of the lectures is that in the early days, the most important American businesses were those that dealt with agriculture, which, by the way, is going to be important right through the course of American history, but also overseas trade. From the very beginning, Americans had been merchants, and American merchants needed some sort of protection on the high seas. They had benefited from the protection of the British Navy, until the American War of Independence, until the American Revolution. After that war was over, the American merchants found themselves at the mercy of pirates, for example, the so-called Barbary pirates who operated out of the Mediterranean, the north shore of North Africa, but also at the mercy of the British themselves and of the French. It just so happened that the American Revolutionary War was one of a long series of wars between Britain and France, a series that went back to the 17th century and continued until the early 19th century. And in fact, after the American Revolutionary War ended, Britain and France caught their breath briefly before going at it again. They were waging a war for international supremacy, and they did everything they could to disadvantage the other side. They did everything they could to damage the commerce of their enemies. So the British, for example, tried to prevent Americans from trading with the French, and the French tried to prevent the Americans from trading with the British. At this time, the United States Navy was nothing to pay any attention to at all, and so American merchants, that is, American captains, found themselves being victimized by the British, being victimized by the French. From the late 1790s until really the War of 1812, which was all about this question of were the British, were the French preying on American commerce excessively, American businesses found themselves whipsawed between one side and the other. And it was only with the completion of the War of 1812, which coincided with the final defeat of Napoleon and which ushered in a century of European peace, were Americans able to get past this problem of having to worry that their ships were going to be captured by major powers overseas. While American commerce was developing and while it was trying to fight its way between the British and the French, the early mainstays of American business were agriculture. Agriculture, in fact, would be the major American industry through the 19th century and through very much of the 20th century. In fact, in terms of total production, agriculture probably remains America's most important business. Agriculture was important for the development of American business in two regards. One, the obvious one, farmers provided the food and fiber on which the activities of the rest of the population were based. There was another angle, though, to American agriculture, an angle that was very important through the entire 19th century, and that was the role of speculation. Farmers were producers of food and fiber, but they were also speculators. Farmers would buy land in the hopes that they could make a profit in the production from the land, but also in the hopes that their land would rise in value. And this would allow them to expand their enterprises or, in many cases, to sell the land and move on. Besides agriculture, overseas trade continued to be an important aspect of American business. Trade in raw materials, of which America had an abundance, raw materials including the food and fiber from farms. Trade in slaves. Now, this is an aspect of American business history that, for obvious reasons, is often overlooked. But the trade in slaves was a major component of American commerce until the beginning of the 19th century. The U.S. Congress banned the overseas slave trade, that is, the import of slaves from overseas, as of 1808. Illegal smuggling of slaves into the United States continued for a while after that. But the internal slave trade, that is the trade of slaves within the United States from one state to another, remained an important aspect of American business right up until the Civil War. And in fact, the idea that slavery was a business, that slaves were property, that was a principal hindrance to the abolition of slavery. There were very many people who in the 1840s and 1850s could see that slavery was immoral, but they also recognized that slavery, the ownership of slaves, was a major aspect of the operation of businesses, particularly agricultural business in the South, and they couldn't see their way around that. American commerce was in raw materials, it was in slaves, it was in other items. And it was also a worldwide operation. This is something that's important to remember. We talk in the early 21st century about the age of globalization and how the world has become small and how American products are found all over the world. In fact, the world was globalizing as early as the 1790s. As soon as the American Revolutionary War was over, American ship captains operating out of Boston and New York began sailing to the Indies, that is what is now the East Indies in India, and to China, to Cathay. They were global traders from the very beginning. And in fact, the China market was one of the most lucrative aspects of early American business, as we will see in the next lecture when I talk about John Jacob Astor, one of the pioneers of the China trade. The first part of American business history, from independence until about 1820 or 1830, can be seen as the age of commerce. So commercial capitalism, if we want to put it in the terms of capitalism. The second period begins about 1820 or 1830, and we can see the beginning of industrial capitalism. So commerce is the first phase. Industry is the second phase. We're going to move into finance after that. The industrial phase of American business history, of American capitalism, emerges with the development of the cotton industry, for example, the textile industry generally. And this is the result of a new innovation. I talked earlier about the role of technology. Well, in the 1790s, Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin. The cotton gin was a labor-saving device that allowed the cotton culture, that is, the planting and production of cotton, to expand throughout the American South. This was the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in America. Now, when I talk about the Industrial Revolution, it's important to bear in mind that in something like an Industrial Revolution isn't like a political revolution. Political revolutions happen more or less overnight. The French Revolution broke out on July 14, 1789. It has a particular beginning date. The Industrial Revolution, though, is something that happens over decades rather than over days or months or even years. So the Industrial Revolution, taken as a worldwide event, actually began in England in the late 18th century. It moved to America in the early 19th century. But the period of the American Industrial Revolution lasts from about the 1820s until the 1880s or 1890s. So bear that in mind when you hear me talk about the Industrial Revolution. The first phase of the Industrial Revolution was the introduction of things like the cotton gin in the textile industry. The second phase was a revolution in American transportation. In particular, the application of steam power to the old means of getting around. The steamboat was invented by Robert Fulton in the first decade of the 19th century. And steamboats made transportation on America's rivers something entirely different from what had been before. Until then, river traffic essentially had to go downstream. Sailing vessels could travel upstream. But once steamboats came along, then rivers became two-way highways of traffic. With the steamboats were developed a system of canals in America. From the 1810s until the 1830s or 1840s, canals became a means of transporting goods throughout the American East and even into parts of the West. The opening of the Erie Canal, for example, in 1825, absolutely revolutionized the American economy because for the first time, the interior of the United States became accessible to the Atlantic seaboard. Steamboats and canals were followed by railroads, and this was when the Industrial Revolution really took off, because railroads, motorized land transport, freed the American economy, freed producers, freed consumers, freed everybody from having to be next to water. The early American cities were all located on the ocean, in harbors, or on rivers. Once railroads were developed, cities could be located wherever they wanted to be, where they could be located, for example, more accessibly to raw materials, more accessibly to just about anything that people wanted. So with railroads, the Industrial Revolution really bloomed. Now, we're going to discover that The Industrial Revolution in the United States was given a great boost, was greatly accelerated by the Civil War. It's a recurrent theme in American business history, not just in American business history, but in the history of nearly every economy, that war is often an impetus to technological innovation, and also it can give a great boost to economies generally. Especially in the United States, the Civil War really pushed the Industrial Revolution into high gear, so that the first phase of the American Industrial Revolution was from about 1820 to about 1860. But once the Civil War began, once the federal government, for example, the Union government, that is, began spending tons of money on the war, it began investing in railroads, it began investing in all of the things that the Northern armies needed to win the war. And this gave a terrific impetus to the evolution of American industry. At about the same time, we see the beginnings of a transition to the third phase of American capitalism or American business development. Phase one, again, was commerce. Phase two is industry. Phase three is the role of finance. So these major enterprises, beginning with the railroads, but including the steel industry, including the oil industry, including all of those aspects of American business that we identify with big industry, had to be funded. Somebody had to come up with the money to make these things work. Until the railroads came along, until the Industrial Revolution, most American enterprises were relatively small-scale things. They were funded and operated as family partnerships, as family businesses. But once you move on to a very large scale, where millions of dollars, instead of just tens of thousands of dollars, when millions of dollars are required to develop a rail network, for example, or to build the latest steel mill, then new means have to be devised for finding the investors who will put the money into these new enterprises. And all of a sudden, a new sort of entrepreneur emerges, an entrepreneur of finance. These are the people who put together the financial packages that make the industrial development possible. Probably the best example of an entrepreneur of American finance capitalism was J.P. Morgan. Well, I'm going to give a lecture on J.P. Morgan. Morgan was the person who demonstrated that finance capitalism was really taking over from industrial capitalism. This carries us up just about to the beginning of the 20th century. And at that point, we revert to another theme that I mentioned earlier on, and that is the role of government. In fact, we've got these three phases: commercial capitalism, industrial capitalism, financial capitalism. Now we enter the phase of, well, government intervention, and we'll see to some degree government cooperation in business development. What happened between the Civil War, ending in 1865, and the beginning of the 20th century, was what could be called a capitalist revolution, in really the capitalist revolution in American history, where capitalism came to the fore, and the institutions of capitalism and the power of the capitalists grew much faster than the institutions of government and the power of government officials. By the beginning of the 20th century, American government officials, American voters, believed that it was necessary to take action to rein in government. So now we'll see that the Thomas Jefferson side of our story begins to intrude on the Adam Smith side of the story. And we're going to discover that throughout the 20th century, this competition, this cooperation, this dance between government and business will continue. And it's one where each side has to accommodate the other. In the course of the 20th century, there are various themes that will emerge. The role of technology. Technology had always been important, but technology becomes more important on an accelerated basis. The role of information technology, for example, with radio, movies, television, electronics. We will see that technological innovation becomes a constant theme in American business in the 20th century. Another theme that will develop in the 20th century is the rise of the consumer. Until the 20th century, the principal problem of American economic history, American business, was the problem of production. How do we make enough? In the 20th century, the problem is how do we sell all that we can make? The consumer becomes the driving force of the American economy in the 20th century. A last thing that we're going to see in the course of the 20th century is something that, in fact, we could have seen earlier in the 19th century. We're going to see right down until the present. And that is the constant recurrence of booms and busts in the American economy. You could call them booms, bubbles, and busts, especially since now in the early 21st century we live in the aftermath of a burst bubble in the high-tech business. But this is an old story. There's new technology, there's new investment, there's reason to believe that the American economy is going to grow. And people throw lots of money at the latest technology, at the latest business sector, thinking that things are going to continue to grow and grow and grow. Until those expectations become burst by some extraneous event, the bubble bursts and things all fall down. There's typically a recession in the 19th century. They were called panics. In the 20th century, they were called depressions. And since then, they've been called recessions. It's a nicer word. Anyway, this is something that happens over and over again. And in fact, it brings us right up to the present. And we will see that all of the things we've been talking about in the course of American business history are issues that are still with us. They've been with us for 200 years, and for all I know, they'll be with us for the next 200 years. Well, that's the outline of the course. In the next lecture, I'm going to be starting back at the beginning with John Jacob Astor, who is a bridge between the American colonial experience and the early years of American independence.
This ends Lecture 1.